the non-Gnostic, the Christian, which considered the Gnostics heresy, they did not see the abstract visual space as a demon, a demiurge. They saw it as the Holy Trinity or as God or whatever, a wonderful situation.
Oh.
And you can see they're both, like humans, we're double beings. We can take one side or another to make it simple.
Mm-hmm.
So we could say this abstract thing is a disservice, or we can say it is a unifying wonder. So that's why the Gnostics were heretics, and the Christians maintained the afterlife was what all life was for. Mm. The afterlife being the not only the psychological survival, but this place that was outside of this world.
Yeah.
Outside of the senses. So I don't think many people, I don't think anybody's ever said that, but I've just spelled out as an interpretation of explaining the last 2,000 years.
Yeah.
Because visual space. So then we get into the electric age, and you start, 150 years ago, people yearning to get past the limitations of visual space. It's become a cliche and all kinds of problems, especially when print came in and caused the fragmentation of the Catholic universe. And so you had Protestant versus the Catholics in the 100 Years' War, those religious wars for 1500s and 1600s. It was a very violent time.
Yeah.
So, by the 1800s, 1900s, under the electric effect, people have been awakened. Finnegan's awakened to other sensory modalities.
Mm-hmm.
And so people started to yearn for symbols within the religious category, which was the idea of a soul. The soul was yearning for other ways to express a multisensual. And as opposed to the anemic visual space effect.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the visual space effect was new and a novelty at the time of Augustine, 400, 500 A.D., or what they call it, Common Era, C.E.
Right.
That it was new. It was a way to get out of the buzz and confusion of centuries of multi-century life.
Right.
Which was the cliche and boring. But now that the visual space runs its course, and then multi-century life, it's interpreted as multi-sensory life, it comes back as a new novelty. And that's why the fascination for the occult, with Blavatsky and all these other movements,
right,
and interest in Buddhism, these were still within religion, the idea of a soul, but sort of incorporating other dimensions, other aspects, which can be reduced or explained as sensory modalities, see?
Mm-hmm.
So it has a great pull on people in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, it's all within the effect of the electric tactile space. The Christians, as McLuhan pointed out, had no idea of the disturbance of visual space, which led to all kinds of violence. The Crusades, the Inquisition, the takeover of North America.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big disturbance of the visual space. They were not aware of the visual space. And so today, we're not aware of the electric space and its disturbances in general, and so we miss the fact that we are in a new situation which religious imagery, religious doctrine doesn't really deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're discarnate. We're already, in some ways, the chemical body has been slopped off by the discarnate electrified TV body.
Mm-hmm.
So that we are in a situation that no culture has ever had a metaphor for.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we get into the first page of text in your book, and we're with LaRouche,
you're missing something. Are we going? There's something before that.
Oh yeah. Before we get to that, let me just finish up with this. I don't know if there's anything more to be said about the abstraction of the vowel from the consonant, but consonants cannot actually be pronounced without pronouncing the vowel. The vowel was always there in the pronunciation. I guess it just wasn't there in the letter system.
That's right. When you look at pre-phonetic writings, the consonants and the vowels are strung, interpenetrating each other. There's no separation.
Oh.
It's when the Greeks took the A, E, I, O, U
mm-hmm.
out of the stream, like a Finnegan's Wake page, the stream of letters, that the just before the Greek world, the effect the phonetic alphabet came in, the consonant vowels were in the same line. They weren't separated.
Oh.
And you're right. You needed to say it. The vowel, it was like a dialectic within the acoustic stream.
Mm-hmm.
Presented as the I, therefore, yeah, you need the vowels to say the consonants. But when you hike the vowels out. Now, another point about you saying the alphabet is empty. The phonetic alphabet is empty. Yes. The phonetic alphabet, the A's and the B, the A, E, I, O, U, the vowels, or even the letters in the phonetic alphabet in general, did not represent any iconic, visible relationship, like an ideogram does.
Yeah.
An ideogram is made up of pictures of what it's spelling out.
Right.
So the phonetic alphabet was totally empty, as McLuhan would define it, semantically meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah. Well, with the Hebrew alphabet, again, it's not my bailiwick. I'm not an expert in it by any means, but I almost have the idea, because the richness of the resonances of the letters, that if you learn to speak the letters in the right combinations, as the Kabbalists talk about these mantras, I mean, you could speak something into creation, and you can't do that with the phonetic alphabet. It just doesn't have it seems to miss the whole magical resonant element.
Look, our whole world, the Western world, comes from the phonetic alphabet. So a lot was created by the phonetic abstract space. I mean, it brought in Euclidean geometry. Then people started looking at nature in a different way. And the Western world eventually
It brought in science and the ability to use the hand and the mind to architect space, but not to just speak something into existence, just sing something into reality.
Well, yes, but there was a lot of singing to balance off that effect. You have to remember that all the senses maintain their actions and their extensions, their arts and artifacts. For example, when the printing press really started taking effect, what did it create? Opera. It's a glorious noise.
Mm.
Right? That was the ear coming back.
Right.
The senses are always in dialogue.
Yeah.
There was lots of ear stuff going on at the time of the phonetic alphabet and on. But when you talk about making things through speaking or using the Kabbalah or a mantra, that is not significant in our time because of the huge environments we're inside of. But you know what's a characteristic of the effect of the digital age? The digital age means that anything, like the chaos butterfly, can trigger off a lot of storms or a lot of ecstasies. So, yes, if you get on the radio and do a mantra for 20 minutes, that's going to affect a lot of people temporarily. The point is, under electric age, no effect lasts long. The visual space effect lasted for 2,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring in mouth stuff, and the mouth is aligned with literacy, you know, the spoken language and the literate are very cohered compared to pre-litter tribes where it's not so mouth-oriented. It's body language and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'd call it mystical magic or weird shamanistic evocations.
Right.
You know? When you're still talking about the power of the word, you're still within the effect of writing. It's like the writing world, if it wants to get wild and wants to let its hair down and party, it goes into acoustic expressions, mouth expressions. But none of them are compared to the shamanistic.
Right.
So today, though, we're in a simulated environment, which is real, alive, and you can see that the Kabbalah and the occult became popular 150 years ago because people said, the very thing you've been expressing, Scott, the Kabbalah is more resonant than the phonetic effect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's starting to retrieve things that seem to, within the literate legacy, the literate heritage, to be more appropriate to the unconscious effect of the electric environment. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll find most of our culture in the last 150 years has been a series of fashions. with certain sensory biases or modalities that reflected the ground of new technologies that were coming in. I mean, definitely swing music was an effect of the movie radio era.
Yeah.
But cool jazz and then rock is definitely television.
Mm-hmm.
It changed the music.
Yeah.
And so to be comprehensive today, it's very hard for people, is that one wouldn't identify with any culture or any fad if one desired to stay tuned in to what was really going on. In other words, it's not particular cultural artifacts that are worshipful, like, let's say, you love Zappa. That's not as relevant as understanding that culture is a byproduct of another process that we should become aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we can become aware of it because we have such a turnover of, quote, culture.
Right.
From sports to fashion to models to cars to radio shows to wars.
Yeah.
All within this amazing digitalized Android meme situation.
Yeah. Yeah, if the fish jumps out of the water onto the sand, back into the water, back onto the sand, back into the... then he can see the water.
Right, and they put a pacer in the fish so he can survive being out of the water.
Yeah.
Or do surgery, give him a drug. So the point is, you will notice this with me, I'm not being negative, but you bring up anything that's in culture, like you've been talking about Kabbalah, I'll always try to put it into a larger ground and weaken your fascination with it. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
You've seen me do that. I do that all the time. I'm not identifying with any. I like McLuhan's definition of imagination. That faculty which is not embedded in any of the senses or extensions of the senses. But that doesn't mean being like a Christian, not of this world, or a Gnostic, not of this world. It's able to participate in an ironic, multisensorial, paradoxical way with the content and the ground, the form and the content, at the same time. That's media yoga.
Yeah.
Which I invented.
Yeah.
And this book is a visual presentation of media yoga. And it's puny. Now, we're talking about how it's thinning its wake. He did it. Yes, this book was designed to be a souvenir for my audience and CKLN in 91-92 after I was off the air and getting ready to go to New York City.
Okay, yeah.
So it's just a little memento. You look in the back of Bob's Medicology's album, since Nelson knew about this book, he called the second album, Bob's Medicology Squared, he called the souvenir from a ritual in progress.
Ah.
And, you know, he understood that my book was that. I used to say that about my book.
Right.
And let's see. So it's just a little holeopathic throwaway. Remember, McLuhan defined McLuhanism as him writing books about his stuff. He said, it reminds me of the Toronto junkyard, help beautify junkyards, throw something beautiful away today.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's what this is.
Cool.
But, you know, and
it's not a throwaway in my library, I'll tell you that.
Oh, that's right. But if you did lose it, you would have my chart to work on. You'd have my radio shows to listen to, which are different media presentations, like the book of the ritual in progress.
Oh.
And the ritual is lockdown Bob Rule via Connie, right?
Yeah.
So it's a throwaway, but it's pretty unique and pretty dense. You could probably build a school around this book, what's in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's a lot in it.
Right.
At least in terms of book content.
Yeah.
So, do you want to say any more before we go to the quote?
No, we'll go ahead. On page 3, there's the dedication to this CKLN audience. And then...
let me just say this. So, page 1 has the title and the full icon of Perfect Pitch at the bottom.
Right.
Page 2 has the credits for publication.
Right.
And then page 3 has a quote. A quote.
Yeah.
You want to read them?
Sure. You want me to read the dedication?
Yeah,
or
you're going to do the reading, probably, as we go into the book, remember?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking it might be fun if, say, like, for instance, you know, the first half of the book is altering between LaRouche and McLuhan.
Yeah.
Why don't I read LaRouche and you read McLuhan, or vice versa? I don't care.
Or you read a page and then I read a page of whoever we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, alternate it, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll read, since I made this quote, the first quote, I'll say it. dedicated to everyone. And notice the E of everyone's capitalized. That's a reference to Here Comes Everybody, you know, H-C-E,
okay.
Which is capitalized in Finnegan's Wake. Dedicated to, I mean, grammatically, I wouldn't need to capitalize that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do. Dedicate to everyone at CKLN-FM. Now, where is CKLN-FM? It's an electronic environment. We don't know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? We know where the hardware makes the power go, but the audience of CKLN is... The people who heard me were at CKLN, which was a place on the dial, but that place was covered many miles and possibilities of reception.
Sure.
So at CKLN. Dedicate to everyone at CKLN FM, because you would be at there when you were listening to it. Then I have brackets, no, then I have comma, audience included. So I'm trying to explain not just the office staff, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Dedicate to everyone at CKLN FM, audience included, who auditioned to be my understudy, and to, of course, and the O of, and the C, of course, is capitalized, which is odd, but I wanted to really emphasize it. And to, of course, inevitably, then cancel that out by saying, perhaps, Connie. So I'm ambivalent about dedicating it to Connie.
And
just dedicate to everyone, and to, of course, Connie.
And she's all spelled in all capital letters.
Like CKLN-FM.
Ah.
She's an extension.
Connie's a media.
Yeah, she's a media. A medium, a media. So, reading it quickly, dedicated to everyone at CKLN-FM, audience included, who auditioned to be my understudy. I better read that better, this way to do it. Dedicated to everyone at CKLN-FM, audience included, who auditioned to be my understudy, and to, of course, inevitably, perhaps, Connie. So, why do you think I put who auditioned to be my understudy?
Because these are your students out there who are tuning in to KCLN.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The CKLN.
CKLN.
Yeah. The I'm saying that just as you're doing now, to interact with me is to audition, to connect with me, and do something with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be presented in all kinds of ways of doing something with me.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, since I presented myself as an authority, sort of, on the shelf, with a sense of humor, people are trying to figure out what you mean, try to understand you. And... potentially, if you really understood it and liked it, you'd want to become an understudy. You'd want to learn it even
more. And then when Bob's on vacation, you get there, Bob's can take over temporarily.
Right. So, who auditioned to be my understudy, part of the meaning was, we haven't necessarily found an understudy, but this book is presented to people who would want and have to master to become an understudy.
Mm-hmm.
So I never said my show was dedicated to understudy,
but
the book is, because it is there for an understudy to really get into it.
Right.
Okay, so then you read the second quote underneath that one.
Okay. It's a little poem, I guess. The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrows followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. And it's a sign to the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah, do you know who wrote that?
I don't.
Heard of
it? No, I don't.
Yeah, Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Okay.
Coleridge, you know, 1800 approximately, friend of Wordsworth and considered a romantic poet.
Yeah.
The Ancient Mariner, people have heard of that. So the Ancient Mariner, they went into some strange places.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in telling his story, he says, we were the first to burst into that silent sea. Now, we have four lines here. The third and fourth line were said by McLuhan. He said he and his buddies, basically Ted Carpenter, were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. The silent sea is the problems that he discovered and the solutions for the 20th century, maybe the 21st century.
The silence relating to the silence of the visual space that we were talking about, the emptiness, visual space we're talking about?
No, yeah, silence is tactility. Because remember, tactile is not any sense.
Oh, that's
so you
right.
couldn't reg- What?
Yeah, you can't even hear it.
That's right. So we were the first to ever burst into that silent tactility,
mm.
or into that tactile speech.
Yeah.
Okay, so he used to say that, but he didn't, and I looked it up once, and I saw the two lines before that. And in this book came out, and I was putting together in fall of 91, but in 1988, Dave Neufeld and I did a four-hour thing called Who's Forgotten Furry Lint, F-U-R-R-Y, which was based on Larry Flint and what happened to him with Rebel magazine in 83, 84.
I never was quite sure why he dedicated the whole show to him. He only plays a, he's a minor league player in terms of the actual play itself.
No, have you read the play?
No, but I've heard it.
Yes. No, but it's not, it's a takeoff on, that's where we got the terms Furry Lint. It's not just about him.
Yeah.
You know, Larry Flint, we switched around, got Furry Lint.
Right.
And it was part of the metaphor was, or meaning was that Larry Flint and his rebel operation, which Mae Belfer was a big part of, got removed from the presidential race in early 84 really quickly by the authorities.
Mm.
I mean, he got put into an MK Ultra kind of prison for a while and got beat up pretty bad.
Oh.
He was a piece of lint on the clothing of and fabric of 80s Reagan America.
Okay.
Easily dispatched.
Yeah.
So who's forgotten Furry Lint? When I present excerpts, audio excerpts from all the holy offices of Club 22 in that four-hour extravaganza, mm-hmm. every one of them is a Furry Lint, just erased. That's why we wonder if we can even remember them.
Yeah.
So you're right to say that it's definitely not about Larry Flint, but he was an example among many within the Mae Brussel holy office mm-hmm. of somebody trying to present an agenda in the information society of the 80s under Android mean conditions, and was very efficiently and quickly dispensed with.
Yeah. I actually didn't know that he tried to run for president.
Oh, yeah, that's what he was doing with Rebel magazine.
Oh. Well, of course, I would think the establishment as a whole would toss him out on his butt. He wouldn't even need an MK Ultra thing. I mean, the guy was the purveyor of hardcore porno, and that doesn't fly in the sensibilities of most Americans.
Right, but what we discussed in Furry Lint through the various holy offices presented, and just for the record, that's McLuhan, LaRouche, Herbert W. Armstrong, Mae Brussel, Frank Zappa, Finnegan's Wake, Cosmic Awareness, Dr. Beter, Garrett Dean, and then all nine of them together, which is the 10th holy office, which is me and my manipulation and modulation of it. Now, what was I saying that for? The MK Ultra is what happened to Flint in the prison. The establishment, it was no problem for the Android meme. It wasn't even the establishment. It was the Android meme that made him irrelevant, made all the holy offices irrelevant. But to be celebrated later, like Wired magazine did with McLuhan, you can bring them back once they're dead and have them as cultural iconography.
Mm-hmm.
But the Android meme, there was no place that Furry Lint thought needed to receive his information. There was no receptor. There was no audience.
Mm-hmm.
So he already was obsolete before he started. So when... yes, it's before MK Ultra. MK Ultra was just a little sentence for his chemical body.
Right.
But what inspires these people to think that they can inaugurate an agenda, a program, usually through their mouth and writings, old media, and think it's going to have an effect?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm still here, and they're not, because I understand what we're up against. And I'm also part of the guys that unleashed the Android meme. So
mm-hmm.
the media yoga keeps my campaign still going strong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you see.
Well, LaRouche's campaign is going strong within the body, the collective body of people who keep pushing the agenda. I mean, it's never going to go anywhere outside of the the collective body of people who participate, but
right.
they keep the fire stoked.
Okay, but there again, you're making the mistake that Ferlin tries to teach. You think that if one has some engagement with some media and has some audience, that that's the way to go. If you're truly aware of the Rumpelstiltskin situation and the Chaos Butterfly situation, I can do what I'm doing and have an audience of four people and maybe be more effective than anybody who has a huge audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're assuming to be on the radar in some media form is effective.
But unfortunately, we can't measure your effectiveness any more than we can measure mine or Larry Flynn's.
Well, okay, here we are in New York City. We haven't been blown up yet in almost 5 years. 4 years, anyway.
We can't measure that you can take a credit for that.
Well, maybe it's irrelevant whether you can measure it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, homeopathy, something you can't measure, has an interesting effect. Homeopathic is a hologram.
Right.
At homeopathic level.
Well, we can study the effects of homeopathy because the doctor gives the patient a remedy, and then they observe that patient for some period of time to see how the symptomology changes.
Right. And we can measure, in Android meme terms, my powerful effect by looking at Twin Peaks, The Matrix, major movies.
Yeah.
There's Bob affecting generations.
Yeah.
And fads. I mean, the Zanocrony factor is there.
Yeah.
Proven by Guffey and many other people since then. So there is me, or not the chemical body me, but what I am in total.
Yeah. Well, you're tapped into the phenomena that gave rise to those at a very deep level, and probably deeper than the Twin Peaks, than the David Lynch and these people that are creating this stuff. We can't know for sure that you directly affected those things, but you know, this could be a general phenomena that a few people are tapping into, but you're tapping into it with clarity on a very deep level.
Right. But look at the fact that I do show up in these movies is an interesting example of what I'm trying to express. Where am I on a sensible level, visible level, how could I be in there? But it's undeniable I'm in there.
Yeah.
So it shows you inside the imploded Android meme, if you understand the ESP, you can affect the collective ESP.
Yeah.
And remember, the Matrix or Twin Peaks are just puny little movie, a TV series. These are puny operations. There's lots of other stuff that you can't measure in other fields that probably have me in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just you saw that post I gave you how they're starting a new party in New York City called the Purple Party.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I don't know why that came up, where it came from.
Yeah.
It
may be that you've closed yourself with the resonant symbols that anybody who's tuned in would pick up on, but you happen to close yourself with them, so it looks like you're doing it.
Yes. How can you tell the dancer from the dance, the famous Yeats poem?
Yeah.
How can you tell the dancer from the dance? I've always made no claims about this. I just state what we see and hear. What it means, we're not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Though I attempt to give a reason, but that's not usually understood, so
right.
Failure. A disconnect. So back to the quote here. So with the operation Who's Forgotten Furry Lind, I was looking at this poem, and there it said, "The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrows followed free." The furrows, the furries, follow free. Now, this is referring to the radio show. So, ostensibly, on my radio show, I offered all kinds of, quote, slack and interesting inspirations and pain and all that stuff. But overall, it seemed to me that I was offering people an approach to get to a state of autonomy or becoming free. So all the furry lints followed me, right? The furrows followed free.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it's the fair breeze blew. We know that the word breeze can refer to bullshitting or talking, right?
Mm-hmm.
We shot the breeze.
Sure.
So it was an oral show on the radio. So the fair breeze blew, and I'm a fair-looking person, and I sound fair. So it's a total description of the way the show sounded. The fair breeze blew, and the white foam flew. we definitely sounded like white boys.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Dyer and I were white. And so McLuhan defines in 1955 his essay on choice and television called TV and Radio for the Absent-Minded, something like that. Radio, TV, and the Absent-Minded. He discusses this foam, the spume and foam in a TV world, which is just the passing content, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I provided many hours of content, which was foam, but it was white foam. And it flew because we were discarnate.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody flew.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get any more perfect words. It's almost like a haiku. I mean, it's 12 words. The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrows followed free.
Mm-hmm.
I think haiku has 14 words. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know.
Anyways, it's like a little haiku describing exactly me.
Mm-hmm.
And this was written, you know, almost 200 years before I happened. And then we were the first to ever burst into that silent sea. That included the top-down of the machinations of the Secret Council 10, which I was chairman of. So, as I told it to people, they had access to information that they never would have heard. They couldn't have heard.
Mm-hmm.
It was locked away in the National Security Act, National Security Silent. So, I don't think you get a better pattern than these four lines.
It is a perfect description of what you were doing.
Yes.
However, I would suggest, because I'm going to play devil's advocate here as we go along, that it's because of the way that you managed to interpret it. And there are many ways that these lines could be interpreted. Anyone could interpret them, find some personal way to interpret them.
Right. Now, there's no problem with that, because the complement to McLuhan's aphorism, the medium is the message, is? Do you remember it?
The complement to
the medium is the message, that aphorism.
Yeah.
You know it. As soon as I say it, you may have thought of it lately.
No, I
but
guess not. Go ahead.
The user is the content.
Right.
So, of course, when someone reads the book, the content of the book is not what the author wrote. It's the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because that making part of his own experience is projected into the words of the book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The book is 50% an external reality that he can't totally hallucinate on.
Yeah.
But the other 50%, the making part of perception, puts the user's own experience into the content.
Mm-hmm.
So the user of a car, the content of the car is the user.
Mm-hmm.
Of any medium. So, of course, this is my projection. But there's nothing wrong with that unless one is trying to be a 19th century scientist and make matching the be-all and end-all and have an objective language or an objective bunch of facts and say, this is what the author meant and has nothing to do with what you project. But that was the illusion of the scientific enterprise, the left hemisphere Gutenberg science enterprise, of extreme matching to some external situation, which external situation was solidified by the frame of visual space. So, and kinetic space, because once you get into the 18th century, you've got visual printed book space, but the movement, the dynamic phase, as William Irwin Thompson calls it, of industry and the extensions of the muscles and the kinetic, which is all those machines. So 19th century, that's why LaRouche and the chart is both visual and kinetic. So the user is the content is the basic aspect of the drama of cognition, which is blocking and merging. I take in only a certain amount of what you say because my brain will assert my experience within what's being said.
Right.
And language is in between us, and it's what holds us together. It's the glue. You use the language. I hear what you say. The interesting thing is the subtlety of I hear exactly what you mean, and I could agree, or I could willfully project my thing, or decide that what you said was correct. What
yeah.
unites us is the participation in the medium of speech.
Right. Interesting concept I came across recently is that wisdom is nonverbal. It's some inherent meaning, but understanding is the ability to take that into your and formulate it into, well, we're using English. So it doesn't become understanding. Wisdom doesn't become understanding until it becomes language.
Right. Now, okay, two points here. Remember this cliche? Those who know say nothing. Those
mm-hmm.
who don't teach.
Yeah.
Now, that on the surface appears to contradict what you're saying, because understanding would be someone who can articulate and teach the wisdom. Right?
Right.
Then we juxtapose, make an ideogram here, juxtapose with that, Zappa. Zappa's little poem from Joe's Garage. Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not beauty, whatever he said. He starts working through it.
Mm-hmm.
So information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not blah, blah, blah. But there's a sequence there. And he ends up saying music is the best.
But because that's his bias.
Right, but he capitalized it. And he could mean, since he wasn't a conventional musician, he didn't have a conventional notion of the specialty of music. In McLuhan terms, he meant participation.
Yeah.
He's a tribal guy.
Yeah.
Participation is the best.
Yeah.
And that can become playing music, having sex and groupies, eating well.
Yeah, and physicists are beginning to look at the universe as being, you know, musical waveforms.
You mean string theory?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what that is? That's taking the acoustic legacy. Since they don't want to deal with tactility, and they can't deal with anemic visual space, which was Newton and then Einstein. Einstein started to multi-sensual it by making visual space curved, right? The light curved. But when you get, and then the quantum made it invisible, and then that invisible period with all those little particles still had the legacy of visual fragmentation. Finally, they moved into acoustic space, an older environment, but not as old as visual space in our own history of the last 500 years. The acoustic resonance of the analog media, radio, TV, movies, and all that, that becomes archetypal and named as a physical ground of us. And so, again, the latest fad in science, string theory, is responding to the tactile and post-tactile era by turning the previous modality of acoustic space into conceptual ground.
Mm-hmm.
Follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah.
So we don't want to identify with the string theorists because there's... My physics deals with... We call it the post-quantum quadrivial. My physics... Jack Cerfati writes the post-quantum. He's moving out of the quantum... And out of the string theory, but probably incorporating string theory, he's trying to get something not limited to the acoustic. And it's very interesting how he describes it. He's pretty good on Bob knowledge in terms of accidentally describing an interaction there. But I say my physics, represented by my chart, is the real post-string theory physics. When we include first nature and second nature and not be limited like visually biased physicists, who are describing second nature, but think they're describing first nature.
Right. Yeah. Because they're describing first nature within the element of technology or language.
Yes, and culture. Which then, you mentioned language. There was another point. Yes, now wisdom so wisdom, not expressed, is the normal gestural, kinesthetic, proprioceptive, intuitive.
Maybe it's a Tao.
Well, it is the Tao, but we shouldn't limit it to the Buddhist notion of Tao, because the Tao includes all the senses. We're talking about wisdom the way that's defined in that.
But what springs from when one is in the Tao, one is always appropriate to the moment. Somehow there's an innate wisdom. One is always appropriate to the moment.
Right. Now, but what's interesting is that to say that those who know don't speak and those who speak don't know, that does not fit into our time because speaking is not a ground anymore. Therefore, you can speak today and it has a quantum effect. It has no effect. You're pretty well saying nothing. So I can talk all I want and claim that I haven't said a word and should be categorized as those who know because I never said anything. Because I know I'm not saying when I limit myself to speech. So that aphorism gets complicated by this discarnate post-tactile situation we're in. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that the wisdom is multisensory. You can even call it ESP. But it's instinctive, if you want to exclude the voice. And then the voice brings in a bit of particularity and forms a culture which creates a hierarchy. So the teachers become the politicians. Yes, from the free speech point of view or from the multisensory point of view, as an anti-environment to speech, wisdom is more valuable. But, or is inevitable in everybody. But the ability to understand is the ability to take the medium of your culture and mold with that. Remember, imagination is that which is not embedded in any of the faculties or extensions. A great writer, a great singer, any of these are artisans, a great potter, are not embedded in the materials they work with.
Mm.
They know how to modulate. They know how it affects people. And a neophyte is nervously within the material, trying to do well, trying to figure it out,
yeah.
And probably identifies with the material and the learning and hasn't got that prerequisite eventual
yeah.
required detachment, which we call finesse, right?
Right. One can only accomplish attachment, I think, when one is in this silence. See, when from the place of silence, phenomena can be observed for what it is and not identified with, and that's the only way.
Right, but look, note your word observe. That's the eye. We need a different kind of observation or yogic posture when we are dispersed and we have a TV body and a chip body, not just a chemical body. Most people think in terms of their chemical body and its relationship to its environment, right?
Right.
Not relevant anymore. That won't work to get to the point of silence. The silent majority was a strategy, as Baudrillard explained, in the 70s, by the discarded chip TV body to counter all the garbage. The silent majority was wise, but people saw the old media, the newspapers, the right wing, the left wing, the columnists, the point of view people, said the silent majority was the apathetic dead people causing all the problems. Baudrillard pointed out, no, the silent majority were wiser than all the commentators.
Mm-hmm.
If we take your line that silence is golden, speech is just silver. But you see, even that gets complicated when we look at all the factors. So the understanding point, the one who can understand, is what McLuhan's PhD thesis is about. It was Socrates and a certain tradition, the rhetorical tradition in Western philosophy, that the rhetorician and the grammarian believed that wisdom included eloquence and speech. So it brought together the fragmented situation of those who know say nothing and those who don't know teach. So speech is eloquent. Speech is necessary, and it complements what you're saying, is that those who understand can speak. But it's the different modalities you speak in.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. When to speak, how to speak, who to speak to is part of externalized wisdom,
mm-hmm.
or the level of understanding. But look at the great title of McLuhan's Understanding Media. Understanding, not wisdom, silence, speech, media. All the modalities and their environments.
Mm-hmm.
Very comprehensive.
Right. Now, I don't think this fits. I don't know if this fits in here or not, but a quote from Carlos Castaneda comes to mind, which is that life has no purpose. However, if one lives life well and has, you know, is a warrior in the sense in which Carlos Castaneda believed one could become a warrior, then one has a life with heart, and that gives in a cosmos in which there is no purpose, that's the only way to live, a path with heart.
Okay, now. You're speaking from the chemical body, and maybe a little bit of the astral body. That's what you mean by heart.
Yeah.
Which is chi and wisdom, to quote the East and the West, right?
Right.
But the thing is that today, in a quantum society, we don't even have a present because too much is going on to measure it. So we have ratings. The Pulsargeist tell us what the present is. Via polls,
mm-hmm.
and marketing based on ratings. That is the manufactured present. That's the manufactured pseudo moment, even though it is real. So we got to be careful how we use the word pseudo. Since nothing is here, then the purposelessness, or what's called nihilism by some people, of daily life can be very alienating. So we need a new way to express the archetypes you were just saying about the be in harmony with nature is to have no purpose. This is a quote McLuhan has in Medium as a Massage. He quotes somebody, maybe it's John Cage, to have no purpose is to put you in harmony with nature. Now note, it's in quotes, therefore it's not what McLuhan's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But what it points to, the chemical body, or the astral body, having a harmonious, non-goal-oriented relationship to first nature, does not deal with the TV body and its turnover, endless change, and no stability, and the chip body, what in relation to first nature and previous second nature. You see, I'm laying out a very complex situation that a simple aphorism like you stated does not give the proper wisdom or understanding of how to talk about this situation.
Right. Yeah, I see that.
Right. So to have heart today, you know, one could say that if I turn on the TV tomorrow, I say, oh, we're going to have an apocalypse. They're still running the electronic environment. This is emphasizing the disservices. So when Oprah gets on, or Katie Couric, or anybody gets on there and has nice platitudes and an emotion and an empathy going on, they're still providing content for a more violent context, which is the television experience,
mm-hmm.
and its effects on previous media.
Yeah.
So that's why platitudes sell and are obsolete, and people make a lot of money from them. But also there's a great cynicism about the new age.